Welcome to the 2014 Shepherd's Conference. One nation under God, today's church, and the shocking truth about the founding of America. Greg Frazier.
Now, concerning the religious beliefs of America's founders, you can't make any general statements regarding the founding fathers. And anytime you hear somebody say, the founding fathers believed such and such, then you should listen very carefully and critically to what they say. Because the founding fathers were a diverse group of individuals, and they all held different views and different beliefs. Just like you can't today say, well, politicians believe this about religion. Can you? I mean, you're going to get quite a bit of different results depending on which politicians you're talking about. The same thing is true of the founding fathers. They were not just a conglomerate of people who agreed on everything. They disagreed on a lot of things. So what I'm talking about today, what I'm going to emphasize throughout my presentation, is the key American founders, eight particular individuals who were most important in determining the principles, the ideas behind the American founding. That's what my whole focus is on. It's on the theology of the period which produced the ideas. It's beliefs that produce ideas. So I'm looking at the beliefs of the key founders, the movers and shakers, and I'll tell you who they are in just a minute. So that's up front. I'm not going to make any claims concerning all the founders. You can't do that, other than, in fact, you can't even with the Constitution, because some of them didn't sign it. But there are certain things you can say, all right, it's the Constitution, so this is what the founders did. But outside of that, it's problematic. Now, what am I trying to get across today? I'm here to tell you, and you'll like this part. Okay, so everybody hear this part. The left is wrong about the founding fathers and their religion. The left is dead wrong. The founders were not a bunch of deists. They were not a bunch of rank secularists. The whole wall of separation between church and state thing is a totally bogus notion. The court is absolutely wrong on that. That is, the founders would not approve that. That was not their idea. They didn't want that. They were not rank secularists. They weren't deists. In fact, I can only find two deists among all the founders, depending on how broadly you make the category founder. There's a lot of different categories of founders, and you have to get pretty broad to find any deists at all. And then you can find two. None of the movers and shakers, none of the important critical people were deists. None of them were rank secularists who wanted to divorce religion from public life. Quite the contrary. They believed in a free society, religion is critically important. When you don't have the arm of the state in a tyrannical or despotical regime with a hammer to beat people down, how do you get them to behave? How do you get people to behave when they're free? And the answer is morality. And where does morality come from? Religion. So they wanted religion in public life. They didn't want a wall of separation between church and state. Now, I could stop there and everybody would go home happy. But I'm not here to make you go home happy. I'm here to try and tell you what I think is right. Equally, the right is wrong about the religious beliefs of America's founders. They were not Christians. Some of them were. I'm not here to say none of the founders were Christians. I'm not here to say there was no Christian influence. But the key American founders, the eight guys I'm talking about, plus a large number of others, the key American founders were not Christians, and they did not intend to create a Christian nation. They wanted religious influence in America. They wanted religion in public life, but it didn't have to be Christianity. They didn't care. Any religion would suit the purpose, because the whole idea was to get morality, and from their perspective, all religions teach morality. Now, if they weren't deists or secularists, and they weren't Christians, what were they? And that's what my book is all about. I coined a phrase, theistic rationalists. They were theistic rationalists. They weren't just rationalists, they were theistic rationalists. They believed in a present God, unlike the deists. They believed in some revelation, unlike the deists. But they were fundamentally rationalists. In other words, in theistic rationalism, you have three parts. You have Protestant Christianity, you have natural religion or deism, and then you have rationalism. Those three elements came together in their minds because of their educational training and the where they grew up. They grew up in a largely Christian ethos and then were trained in Enlightenment rationalism. And those things all collided together and caused them to form a hybrid belief system, which I call theistic rationalism. And they believe that for the most part, all three of those roads will take you to the same place. Christianity, natural religion, and rationalism, for the most part, will go to the same place. But when you come to a crossroads where they don't agree, then which way do you go? We would go the Christian road. Two guys among the founders would go the natural religion deism road, but the bulk of them went down the rationalism road. And they jettisoned things from Christianity that they found to be irrational and retained as much as they could. They retained as much as they could of Christianity and threw out what they considered to be irrational. Same with deism. They believed deism was irrational too. So they jettisoned the elements of deism and natural religion that they thought to be irrational and retained as much of that as they could and created a sort of a hybrid religion, which I spend 240 pages laying out. So what am I going to do today? Well, what I'm going to do today is two things. First of all, I don't expect you to take my word for it. Even if Dr. MacArthur and Mark Dever and Al Mohler and Tom Pennington all, you know, push my book and say, you know, they like it and so on and so forth. I don't expect you to take my word for it any more than you take Dr. MacArthur's word for it for the Bible. But you check it out yourself, right? So what we're going to do is spend some time looking at what the founders themselves said. That's what the almost whole presentation is going to be. What did they say they believed? So you don't have to take my word for it. What did they say they believed? And then we're going to spend a little bit of time on how it matters for the church, but fundamentally that part is covered by your handout. The handout is why I think it matters for the church and why I think it's important for pastors to have an understanding of it. Because a lot of people say, hey, that was 220 years ago, what difference does it make today? I'm trying to run a church. Because chances are the Christian America movement has infiltrated your church. Some of you may be involved in it. Some of you may believe the Christian America thing, and that's perfectly fine. I'm not here to say that, but I'm just here to say it's wrong. But it's perfectly fine if you want to believe that. But I'm going to suggest to you that it's actually dangerous, and that's on the sheet of paper that I gave you as a handout. And I'm going to try and demonstrate why by looking at what the founders themselves said they believed. So that's where we're going. Okay? Now, first of all, just to give you a little heads up on this whole thing, and I hope it can be, yeah, it should be seeable. Here's a basic chart. What I did was I took 10 fundamental beliefs of Christianity that 18th century American churches held. Okay, so what was the standard of Christianity then in America? Not today, not my opinion of what Christianity is, but what did the churches then say Christianity is? And here I picked, out of their creeds and confessions, I picked 10 that they all agreed on. Doesn't matter where, you know, whether it's Baptist or Lutheran or Presbyterian or Congregationalist, they all agreed on these fundamental 10. And most of you, if you're looking at this list, you're saying, yep, 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 right? And you can check them off right down the line. You say, yep, that's good, that's good, that's good. This is Christianity, okay? Now, and I include the Catholics because I wrote a scholarly book. And so the Catholics have to be accounted for, and it just so happens they agree with all 10 of them. And some of you are going to say, wait a minute, they don't believe in justification by faith. Well, that's what the asterisk is for. They believe that you need justification by faith, but plus other things. But you do need faith, right? So that's what the asterisk is for, and it's explained down here. All right, so these are the fundamentals that Christians believed in 18th century America, and we still believe today. The theistic rationalists, the founders that I'm talking about, that's this column. You'll notice that it's rather barren. They believe firmly in one of the 10. That is that there is an active God, active in human affairs. They believed in a present God, active in human affairs, unlike the deists. That's a major thing that separates them from the deists. Okay? And then on some of these other things, some of them believed him and some of them didn't, depending on whether they thought they were rational or not. Some thought the virgin birth was rational, some didn't. Some thought the resurrection was rational, some didn't. And on Scripture, they believed that some of written Scripture was from God and legitimate revelation, but not all. And they chose which parts of revelation were actually revelation based on what? Reason. Their own reason. They decided what was rational that a God would say. What would God write? What would be God's word? All right, I can't stay there any longer. We got to go. All right, who are the key American founders that I'm talking about? First of all, the three guys most responsible for the Declaration of Independence, which is what produces the principles, the basic principles and ideas of America. Often when people are talking about principles and ideas today, they talk about the Constitution, and then when they cite them, they're actually citing the Declaration of Independence. This is a source of principles and ideas. Those three guys are Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin. Then, the ones most responsible for the U.S. Constitution and putting it into effect: James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, Gouverneur Morris, and James Wilson. Now, the latter two names will no doubt be unfamiliar to you. You probably don't have any bills in your wallet that have their pictures on it. Oh, here's my Gouverneur Morris. I'm going to pay for dinner. Unfortunately, these guys are not well known. They should be much better known. Gouverneur Morris, for example, if you're familiar with the Constitution, he wrote the preamble of the Constitution. Furthermore, the Constitution is actually in his handwriting. He actually styled the words of the Constitution. James Madison said that he did, as well as we know it anyway, but Madison gives him credit for the wording of the Constitution. James Wilson was very important in the presidency and judiciary things and whatnot. And then, of course, George Washington, the 500-pound gorilla in the room. So these are the eight key founders that I'm talking about. We're going to start with John Adams. We're going to start with John Adams because John Adams is the most commonly claimed and most commonly quoted founder in the Christian America movement, because he is put forward as the obvious example of a Christian. It's harder to make the argument for Jefferson and Franklin and so on. And so they say, well, obviously John Adams. Now why? Because he belonged to a Congregationalist church. That's basically the evidence for him being a Christian. He belonged to a Congregationalist church. But his church, when he was a young man, had already turned Unitarian, officially. You can, by the way, find the church's website. They have a website because the church is still going today, and they'll tell you when they turned Unitarian. And it was when Adams was just a young man, about college age. But be that as it may, what did John Adams, supposedly an Orthodox Christian, say that he believed? First of all, he referred to the deity of Jesus Christ and his satisfaction for the sins of man as absurdity. Satisfaction for sins, otherwise known as atonement. The deity of Christ and his atonement, absurdities. And by the way, some people, when I deal with some people, again, in the Christian American movement, some of them will say, well, Adams was an Orthodox Christian as a young man, and then he went nuts when he turned older. He lost his salvation and went, you know, crazy as an adult. This is 1756 when John Adams was a very young man. Okay, this is not 1820. By the way, I didn't clarify this either. We could spend this whole time talking about why they weren't deists. Why they weren't deists. If you were a secular audience, as I did when I spoke at Colgate University, for example, if you're a secular audience, then I'm doing a whole different presentation telling you how they weren't secularists and they weren't deists. So don't think I'm picking on the Christian America people, okay? I'm just doing that because that's what I expect you mostly think and what it matters to you, because that's what you're going to encounter in your churches, okay? All right, so what about the Trinity? The Pythagorean as well as the Platonic philosophers probably concurred in the fabrication of the Christian Trinity. Pythagoras was a famous mathematician who dealt with triangles. And so when you're talking about three sides of things, then Adam says, Pythagorean philosophers and Platonic philosophers probably created this notion of the Christian Trinity, fabricated it. Here is the most outrageous thing I encountered in my whole study. By the way, I studied this for 30 years before writing this book. The most outrageous thing I encountered in 30 years of study. Adam said this, had you and I, speaking to Jefferson here, had you and I been 40 days with Moses on Mount Sinai and admitted to behold the divine Shekinah, and there told that one was three and three one, we might not have had the courage to deny it, but we could not have believed it. We could not have believed the doctrine. We should be more likely to say in our hearts, whatever we might say with our lips, this is chance, there is no God, no truth, this is all delusion, fiction, and a lie, or it's all chance. If God himself on Mount Sinai, where God revealed himself, right? That's where God revealed himself to Moses. If God himself on Mount Sinai told Adams that the Trinity was true, he wouldn't believe it. That's pretty adamant. An incarnate God, an eternal, self-existent, omnipresent, omniscient author of this stupendous universe suffering on a cross? My soul starts with horror at the idea, and it has stupefied the Christian world. It has been the source of almost all the corruptions of Christianity. What has been the source of almost all the corruptions of Christianity? The incarnation and the crucifixion. Now, he says the corruptions of Christianity. This is a very important phrase. We're going to see it again more than once. There was a guy named Joseph Priestley, who if you know anything about science, you may have heard of him. He more or less, depending on how you describe it, discovered oxygen. Okay, so he's a well-known scientist, but he was also a preacher. He wrote a multi-volume book called A History of the Corruptions of Christianity, in which he laid out all the ways that Christianity had been changed and corrupted by priests and religious people down through the ages. The first chapter is on the deity of Christ. That's the first corruption of Christianity. Then it goes into the atonement, original sin, and you just go right down the line of your church's doctrinal statement, and those are the corruptions of Christianity, according to Joseph Priestley. For Joseph Priestley and these guys, Christianity is fundamentally Jesus' moral teaching. The moral teaching of Jesus. That's what real Christianity is. Anything else is corruptions of Christianity, and we'll see more of this. What about the Bible? Philosophy, which is the result of reason, is the first, the original revelation of the Creator to his creature man. No subsequent revelation supported by prophecies or miracles, the Bible, can supersede it. No subsequent revelation supported by prophecy or miracles can supersede reason, philosophy. And I note here, he wrote this on Christmas Day, which I find ironic. He also said, the Bible is the most Republican book in the world, therefore I will still revere it. Hopefully none of you are saying amen, even if you're Republicans. That's in a Republican small r, by the way, not the party. But he liked it politically, therefore he would still revere it. What about theology? The preamble to the laws of Zaleucus, which was supposedly handed down from the goddess Athena, is as orthodox as Christian theology as Priestley's, which, as I told you, he identified with. He agreed with Priestley. That was his view of Christian theology. He said, the laws of Zaleucus handed down from Athena is just as good theology as Priestley's. Where is to be found theology more orthodox or philosophy more profound than in the introduction to the Shastra, which is a Hindu text? Where can you find better theology, more profound than in the Shastra, a Hindu text? These doctrines, sublime, if there ever were any sublime, Pythagoras learned in India, taught them to Zaleucus and his other disciples, all ended in heaven if they became virtuous. Zaleucus, an ancient guy, ancient Greek, before the birth of Christ, not a convert to Judaism, ended in heaven because he was virtuous. He was good. He was a good man. In regards to that, Adam said, "My religion is founded upon the love of God and my neighbor, in the duty of doing no wrong, but all the good I can. I believe, too, in a future state of rewards and punishments, but not eternal." They believed in hell, but they didn't believe it was eternal. They believed that they had sort of a purgatorial notion of hell, that if you were good, you went straight to heaven. If you were bad, then you spent time in hell until Christ worked on you some more, and then eventually you made it in heaven. But eventually everybody gets there. That was the fundamental view of the afterlife. And he said, "I believe that all good men are Christians." That's the bottom line. Are you good? Are you moral? Placing all religion in grace and its offspring faith is anti-Christianity. Doesn't get much clearer than that. My religion, you know, is not exactly conformable to that of the greatest part of the Christian world. It excludes superstition. Most of the Christian world, in other words, includes superstition. So much for the clearly Christian John Adams. Now let's get into the problematic people. Let's talk about Thomas Jefferson. Now, when I talk with Christian America people, they say it's not fair to bring up Thomas Jefferson because he was a deist and everybody knows it. He was totally different than the other guys. He's an outlier. It's not fair. And then they turn right around and proceed to quote the Declaration of Independence, which Thomas Jefferson wrote. You can't have it both ways. Plus, I'm here to tell you that Jefferson's religion was not radically different than the others. In fact, I could point you to, and I do in the book, where John Adams himself says to Jefferson in a letter, "Your religion and mine are exactly the same." They went back and forth with religious discussions all the time, and they understood exactly where each other stood, and they said they agreed with each other, and they did. They were both theistic rationalists. So what did Jefferson say? What about the Trinity? "The metaphysical insanities of Athanasius of Loyola and of Calvin are, to my understanding, mere relapses into polytheism." If you believe in the Trinity, you're a polytheist. You believe in three gods. "When we shall have done away the incomprehensible jargon of the Trinitarian arithmetic that three are one and one is three, then," he goes on to say, "we'll begin to make progress," and so on and so forth. The incomprehensible jargon of the Trinitarian arithmetic. "The hocus-pocus phantasm of a god like another Cerberus with one body and three heads." If you know anything about Greek mythology, the Cerberus was the hound of hell, the hound that guarded the gates of Hades, and he had three heads so he could see in different directions and not let anybody slip by. The hound with three heads, and that's what he says, that's essentially what the Trinity is. It's another mythological thing like the Cerberus. "And the day will come when the mystical generation of Jesus, by the supreme being as his father, in the womb of a virgin," the virgin birth, "will be classed with the fable of the generation of Minerva in the brain of Jupiter." If you don't know Roman mythology, Jupiter was the supreme god, his wife was pregnant, Jupiter was angry, he didn't want a child, so he swallowed his wife. And after he swallowed his wife, she eventually gave birth, and the child burst out of the brain of Jupiter. That sounds just like the biblical account of the birth of Christ, doesn't it? I get a message to a couple of places on why the Bible is written the way it is. And one of the things I point out is, contrary to what a lot of people claim, the Bible doesn't sound at all like mythology. Not at all. There's no relationship between the Bible and mythology. And this is just a classic example. But to Jefferson, it was all the same. To the corruptions of Christianity, I am indeed opposed, but not to the genuine precepts of Jesus himself. I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be. Sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, ascribing to himself every human excellence, and believing he never claimed any other. Now, there's several things we have to unpack here. First of all, notice he begins with, to the corruptions of Christianity he's opposed. That's another reference to Priestley and to the fundamental doctrines of Christianity that they call corruptions. Okay? Then we have this statement in the middle, I am a Christian. A very common thing done by Christian America advocates is to take quote, I am a Christian, ... end quote, and then say, look what Jefferson says. But does he mean that he's a Christian in the sense that you and I mean we're Christians? No, he means it in his own sense. He's created his own version of Christianity in his own mind, and that's what he's saying. And the use of the three little dots, the ellipses, is very important to the Christian America movement. I'm not on a personal campaign against anybody. I'm trying to get at truth, etc. But David Barton cannot make his arguments without ellipses. He cannot make his arguments without ellipses. That is, taking out words and replacing them with three little dots. And using ellipses is critically important in scholarly work. You'll find tons of them in my book. You'll find lots of ellipses. The key is, how do you treat them? To be intellectually honest, when you use ellipses, you cannot change the meaning of the statement. You cut out words that are extraneous and don't matter, but you can't change the meaning of the sentence. If you do, it's intellectual dishonesty. And that's what happens here. Notice also he says, ascribing to himself, Jesus only claimed every human excellence and never claimed any other. Now, it's easy for Jefferson to say that Jesus never claimed to be God because when he rewrote the New Testament, he cut out all the verses where Jesus claimed to be God. His version, which you can still buy today, it's still in print, it's now called the Jefferson Bible. That isn't what he called it. If you look at the Jefferson Bible, you won't find any of the verses where Jesus claimed to be God, and so they took up stones and tried to kill him, right? Those verses aren't there, so of course Jefferson can say he never claimed any other. Not in his version. Now, what about what he believed and didn't believe in Christianity? He lists a number of what he calls artificial systems invented by ultra-Christian sects, unauthorized by a single word ever uttered by Jesus. And what are these artificial systems? Including the Immaculate Conception of Jesus, his deification, the creation of the world by him, his miraculous powers, his resurrection and visible ascension, the Trinity, original sin, atonement, regeneration, election, and he goes on. And then most of the rest of them are Catholic things. In other words, your church's doctrinal statement is artificial systems created by ultra-Christian sects and not authorized by Jesus himself. Because real Christianity is the moral teachings of Jesus, not these other doctrinal things. My fundamental principle would be the reverse of Calvin's, that we are to be saved by our good works, which are within our power, and not by our faith, which is not within our power. Pretty straightforward. What about the Bible? Writing to his beloved nephew, he said, read the Bible then as you would read Livy or Tacitus. Those are Roman historians, ancient Roman historians. Your own reason is the only oracle given you by heaven. Your own reason is the standard. Regarding the writers of the New Testament other than the Gospels, he said, these pseudo-evangelists pretended to inspiration. I mentioned to you that they believed that some of the Bible was revelation from God. Jefferson took it to the extreme. The only part of the Bible he believed was the four Gospels. And then not quite all of that. He took a pair of scissors and cut up an actual Bible, cut up the four Gospels, cut out all the supernatural elements and all of the miracles, and then pasted it back together. That's what's now called the Jefferson Bible, which you could buy at a bookstore. All the other New Testament writers were pseudo-evangelists who pretended to inspiration. Or how about this? Everybody's seated, right? I don't want anybody to pass out. He regularly refers to the New Testament, other than the Gospels, as a dunghill. That's his favorite term for the rest of the New Testament. It's a dunghill. What about the Apostle Paul? Of this band of dupes and imposters, Paul was the great Corypheus, or leader of the chorus, and the first corrupter of the doctrines of Jesus. And again, I'm not here, let me repeat this, I'm not here to pick on David Barton. It's just he's the 500-pound gorilla in the Christian America movement. And I was involved recently with a group of historians dealing with his most recent book that got pulled by the publisher, The Jefferson Lies, in which he's trying to say that Jefferson was a Christian early in his life and then later went a little bit off the rails, but was still in the general camp and so on. And by the way, well, I don't have time to go into that. Never mind. There was a lot of misinformation that went out about that. But anyway, you can see where Jefferson is, I hope. What about heaven? How do you get there? There is not a Quaker or a Baptist or a Presbyterian or an Episcopalian, a Catholic or a Protestant in heaven. On entering that gate, we leave those badges of schism behind and find ourselves united in those principles only in which God has united us all. Let us not be uneasy then about the different roads we may pursue, different roads to heaven. This is another standard view of theirs. To that our last abode, but let us be happy in the hope that by these different paths we shall all meet in the end. Many roads to heaven, ever heard that? Pretty standard in our society today, right? I believe that he who steadily observes these moral precepts in which all religions concur will never be questioned at the gates of heaven as to the dogmas in which they all differ. The theistic rationalists hated doctrines because doctrines divide. And they wanted to have unity in this free society that they are creating. So they wanted religion, but not doctrines and dogmas. Benjamin Franklin is another one that people say it's unfair to mention, and yet he was a critical part of the Declaration Committee. And one of, sort of the resident philosopher among the founders. I'm also here again to tell you that unlike what most of the secular scholars will tell you, and well, everybody will, Jefferson and Franklin were not deists. And if I could do the other half of it and tell you how Jefferson was not a deist and how Franklin was not a deist, Franklin specifically stated, he specifically criticized deism in one of his essays. They were theistic rationalists. They thought deism was irrational also. Okay, just to get that out there. Now, I mentioned earlier that quote by Adams is the most outrageous thing I found in 30 years of study. Here's the saddest quote I found in 30 years of study. Benjamin Franklin, when he writes this, is in his 80s and actually is about to die. He's only a couple months from his death, or weeks from his death. And he knows it, or he suspects it. And Ezra Stiles, a Congregationalist minister or a Baptist minister, writes him and asks him his opinion of Jesus. Okay, and he knows he's about to die. As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals and his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see, but I apprehend it has received various corrupting changes, and I have doubts as to his divinity, though it's a question I do not dogmatize upon, having never studied it, and think it needless to busy myself with it now, when I expect soon an opportunity of knowing the truth with less trouble. In other words, I'm going to die and find out much easier whether Jesus is God or not. And unfortunately, he did, and he found out, and it wasn't happy. I see no harm, however, in its being believed if that belief has the good consequences of making his doctrines more respected and better observed. It's all about the morality of Jesus, his system of religion, his teachings. As long as those, it's okay if you want to believe that he was God. If you want to believe in the deity of Christ, that's okay. I don't have a problem with that, because what's important is the moral teachings. And if it gets you to follow his moral teachings, then plenty good. Now, first of all, I want to point out Jesus of Nazareth. That was a way of emphasizing the humanity of Jesus. They didn't talk about Jesus Christ. They didn't talk about Christ. It was just Jesus or Jesus of Nazareth to emphasize his humanity. Then here, this is very important to note, and this is why you need someone with a PhD who studied this for 30 years to tell you instead of just handing out the handout to you. I'm sorry. I have doubts as to his divinity, he says. You have to understand, in the 18th century, which is where I spend most of my time, in the 18th century, if someone was your friend or someone that you respected and you disagreed with them on some point, then you would say, I have doubts as to that. If you didn't like them or they weren't your friend, then you would be blatant and say, you're an idiot, like people would do today. But back then, they were much more civil. So it was, I have doubts. And what that means is, I don't believe it. As you can see in the rest of it, having never studied it, and it's not harmful if you believe it, and so on. All sects, he said, have experienced my goodwill in assisting them, and as I have never opposed any of their doctrines, I hope to go out of the world in peace with them all. Franklin was one of the, I call Franklin the Japanese founder. You ever heard missionaries to Japan who talk about how frustrating it is because they preach Jesus and preach Jesus, and if people respond, then they put Jesus in with the rest of their idols, add it to the collection? Franklin is one of these cover all your bases people. He gave money to every church in Philadelphia as a subscription, as a tithe. He gave to all the churches, and then he was the leader of a project to build a church that didn't have a set pastor. It was for anyone who wanted to preach. And he designed it so that Joseph Priestley would have a place to preach. So that's why he says he's never opposed any of their doctrines. He's assisted them all. He hopes to go out of the world in peace with them all because he hasn't opposed any. All right. We're going to have a little quiz. Identify the Christian president. You got two choices here, A and B. President A was a Baptist, President B, Episcopalian. President A claimed to be a Christian, President B never claimed to be a Christian. President A took communion publicly and in fact got in trouble for it once. President B refused to take communion and was publicly chastised by his minister for his bad example. President A had an advisory council of evangelical ministers. President B, his advisors denied the fundamentals of Christianity. If we're going to make a case for somebody being a Christian, you can make a stronger case for Bill Clinton than you can George Washington. I had a Christian America guy came to our school and spoke, and he told my students, if George Washington was not a Christian, then I'm not a Christian. And I was thinking, well, first of all, I can't believe you said that. But secondly, I wouldn't say that about anybody. I wouldn't say that about John MacArthur or Al Mohler, right? The standard is Christ, not some other person. But anyway, be that as it may. Let's deal with the 500-pound gorilla in the room that both sides desperately want in their camp, George Washington. Unlike Adams and even Jefferson, Washington never claimed to be a Christian. We have over 20,000 pages of his writings. 20,000 pages, and they're online. You can do a search. Put in search terms and see if you can find him claiming to be a Christian, but I could save you a lot of time and effort. Nor did he ever claim to have a relationship with Jesus or to have been converted. Many claims are made based on the spurious Washington Prayer Journal. If you've seen Peter Lilbach's book, for example, he makes a lot of claims in there, and there are others that do as well. They're all based on the Washington's Prayer Journal. But there's no evidence that it was Washington's. First of all, it's not in his handwriting. There's no evidence he ever owned it or knew of its existence. And all the ideas in it are contrary to what everything else he wrote throughout his life. The Smithsonian doesn't accept it as his. The Washington Papers Project doesn't accept it as his. Mount Vernon Society doesn't accept it as his. It was passed down in the Washington family. It belonged to someone in the Washington family somewhere. I don't mean necessarily his immediate family, just the Washington family. We don't know who wrote it, whose it was, but it's not in Washington's handwriting, and there's no evidence it was his. It may not even have existed yet at that point. On March 3rd, 1797, a group of clergymen tried to get Washington to affirm whether he was a Christian or not. They were frustrated when Washington refused to do so, and one of them said the old fox was too cunning for us. Which is interesting for someone who's a Christian to, first of all, not admit it openly, and secondly, not even clergymen are trying to get you to admit it. Washington never took communion. And after being publicly chastised for his bad example, he never again attended a sacrament Sunday. Washington never took communion, and so the assistant rector of his church, here's a guy I want to meet in heaven. Here's a guy with hair. He publicly chastised George Washington for his bad example in not taking communion. Washington responded by writing him a letter and saying, I totally agree with you, you're exactly right, it is a horrible example, I'll never do it again. And then he just quit attending on Sacrament Sunday. This is according to his granddaughter, Nellie Custis, who lived with the Washingtons, according to Bishop William White, the overseer of the local churches, and Dr. James Abercrombie, the chastiser. He spoke of Christians in the third person. He said this, being no bigot myself to any mode of worship, I am disposed to indulge the professors of Christianity. Now, that's not me, I'm a professor, but a professor of Christianity means someone who professes it. Though I am disposed to indulge those who profess Christianity, that road to heaven, which to them shall seem the most direct, plainest, easiest, and least liable to exception. So first of all, he's speaking of Christians in the third person, about them and those professors of Christianity. We need to clarify this. Here's another case where you need an 18th century understanding. The term bigot. In the 18th century, if you use the term bigot in relationship to religion, it just meant if you were a bigot, that was someone who had doctrinal beliefs. If you held firm to a doctrine, then you were a bigot on that. If you were a firm member of a particular denomination, you were a bigot to whatever beliefs they held. He's saying he is no bigot to any mode of worship. In other words, he doesn't have any firm doctrinal beliefs. He studiously avoided mentioning the name of Jesus. In 20,000 plus pages of his writings, there's only one reference to Jesus, Jesus Christ, or Christ. And again, you can do your own search. And that is not in his handwriting and not accepted as Washington's by the Smithsonian or the Washington Papers Project. Here's the deal. During the Revolution, he had some aides who wrote his official documents, just like presidents have speechwriters, right, who write their speeches. He had the same thing, and he had aides who wrote the various commands and things, and then he would look at them and sign them or not, so on and so forth. He had an aide who was a staunch Christian, who sometimes put Christian content into the orders or into the statements. And then we have Washington's own handwriting where he scratches things out and changes it. Well, in one of them, he didn't change it. And so that's the one time that's in the papers that includes the name of Jesus. The one time he didn't change it to something else, which we'll see in a moment, the kind of thing that he did. But it was written by this aide. Washington always used what I called God words in place of any terms specific to Christianity, the Bible, or any other religion. Almighty hand, author, builder, architect, those kinds of God words that aren't specific Christian terms. For example, in a speech to Indian leaders written by a clerk, that same clerk, He crossed out the word God and substituted the great spirit above. Why? Because that's their notion of God, and all notions of God are the same. Many roads, we just saw the quote a minute ago. The road, let the professors of Christianity take the road which to them seems best. Well, the Indians have their own road too, and their own notion of God. It's interchangeable. His use of God words and his belief that all roads lead to God are best understood when one remembers that Washington was an enthusiastic Freemason. Now, let me get something clear. Please, no one come up afterwards and talk to me about Freemason conspiracy. I am not a Freemason conspiracy person. I don't believe it. You're not going to be able to convince me. Don't bring me, show me the dollar bill and so on, okay? So I'm not talking about his Freemasonry as a conspiracy matter. I don't believe in the Freemason conspiracy, all right? However, it's still significant that he's a Freemason. And the Christian America people will say, well, he was technically a Freemason, but he never really practiced it. He wasn't enthusiastic. He laid the Capitol cornerstone in a Masonic apron with a Masonic trowel at the head of a Masonic parade. The Capitol building, if you go to the Congress's house today and look at the cornerstone, Washington laid that cornerstone when they were building the building, and it was with a Masonic trowel in a Masonic apron. His favorite portrait of himself was in his Masonic regalia. And if you go to the George Washington Masonic Memorial, you can see the chair that he sat in as master of the Alexandria Lodge. He was more than a casual Mason. Okay? He and Franklin were both Freemasons among these eight that I'm talking about. What about Freemasonry and belief? Freemasonry holds to a unitary supreme being, the so-called great architect of the universe. It denies Christ's unique saviorship and atonement and reduces religion to a moralistic observance of allegedly common ethical principles. All meet together and pray and worship together to the same one and only indivisible God whom all religions acknowledge and venerate. And that's pretty much exactly down the road with Washington and the other theistic rationalists, for that matter, although, as I said, only Washington and Franklin were Freemasons. He also steadfastly refused to kneel in prayer. Now, I'm sure all of you kneel in prayer, and this is a fundamental of the faith, and so if he didn't kneel, that means he's not a Christian. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, first of all, it was the custom. So if you went to church, to his church on a Sunday, and it came prayer time, everyone else would be kneeling and Washington would be standing, which is a little weird. But that's not the issue. That's not the issue. I bring this up for this point. The famous painting and picture of Washington praying in the snows of Valley Forge. Okay? This is a totally bogus event. The man who was supposed to have found Washington kneeling in prayer at Valley Forge, a farmer named Isaac Potts, was nowhere near Valley Forge in 1777. By his own admission, he bought the property after the war was over. He moved there near the end of the war. Where did this come from? This came from a hagiography. You know what a hagiography is? It's a biography that's effusively praising of someone that makes them out to be a saint or whatever. A hagiography was written right after the death of Washington by Parson Weems, Mason Locke Weems. It's still in print today, The Life of Washington. It's very entertaining. And it's the source of a lot of the Washington stories that we're familiar with, like the cherry tree story. You ever wondered where the cherry tree story came from? I hope you didn't think it was true. That's from Mason Locke Weems' Life of Washington. The story of Washington throwing the silver dollar across the Potomac. Any of you ever been to Mount Vernon? Have you stood on the bank of the Potomac? What are the odds that someone threw a silver dollar across it? When I went to Mount Vernon, I had my wife take a photograph of me. I brought a silver dollar with me on the trip just for that purpose, so I could stand on the shore behind Washington's house of the Potomac, ready to throw the silver dollar a mile across the Potomac. The Potomac is a mile wide. He didn't throw a silver dollar across the Potomac. Weems heard a story about when Washington and another young man were vying for the affections of a young lady, Washington bet the other guy that he could skip a rock across the Rappahannock, which was 100 yards across. And Weems turned it into throwing a silver dollar across the Potomac. That's how accurate Weems' history is. When we visited Mount Vernon, we went up to the room where Washington died, the bed in which he died, and everybody's looking at it, oh, wow. And I'm the only person in the room who's doing this. And my wife said, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking at how they patched the ceiling after the angels came and pulled him up. Because that's what Weems said happened. The angels descended and pulled Washington straight to heaven. All right. What did Bishop White, the overseer of the churches that Washington attended, say after Washington's death? I do not believe that any degree of recollection will bring to my mind any fact which would prove General Washington to have been a believer in the Christian revelation. Reverend Samuel Miller, pastor of one of the churches that Washington attended, how was it possible for a true Christian to die without one expression of distinctive belief or Christian hope? Now, there is no smoking gun quote that I can give you by Washington which would prove to you that Washington was not a Christian. However, I have a whole chapter on him in my book, and you can see a lot of circumstantial evidence. And in the absence of any evidence that he's actually a Christian, I think it's pretty overwhelming, especially when he refused to ever say it, even when they were trying to trick him. What do we conclude about the founders? The key founders were religious men, but not Christians. They believed religion was extremely important, as I said at the beginning, indeed critical to the health of a free society, but not necessarily Christianity. They believed religion and morality were fundamental pillars of society, but that virtually any religion would serve the purpose. Now, I got a couple minutes left. We've got to look at a couple other things. So what about this evidence, quote-unquote, of the Christian founders? I'm just going to give a couple of examples in different categories of false evidence and misrepresentation that's out there. The first is creating quotes. On page 120 of The Myth of Separation by David Barton, James Madison is quoted as saying, religion, ... is the basis and foundation of government. Here's the actual quote. Religion is the basis and foundation of government. Now, if you read through the quote, we don't have time because I'm already over time. If we read through the whole thing, you'd see he's not actually saying religion is the rigid, it's the Declaration of Rights that is the basis and foundation of government, but it sounds better the other way, so we'll just change it. Or quotes out of context. The Christian American people always complain that the left takes quotes out of context, and they do. But so do them, in many ways worse. Here's the quote as presented. John Adams said, "The general principles on which the founders achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity." ... In the actual quote, Adams listed the types of men who brought about independence, including Roman Catholics, Universalists, Arians, Socinians, Deists, and Atheists, and Protestants who believe nothing. Then said, the general principles on which the founders achieved independence were the only principles in which that beautiful of assembly young men could unite. And what were these general principles? I answer, the general principles of Christianity in which all those sects were united. Now, name me one principle, religious principle, in which all those sects are united. They're united in their belief in morality. That's what Christianity is about, and so that's the general principles of Christianity that he's talking about. So again, to use that quote in an evangelical audience, which is the common thing, when Adams and Jefferson and these guys had their own view of Christianity, which is something entirely different, is just intellectually dishonest. Adams went on to claim in the same thing that he could fill sheets of quotations in favor of these principles with statements from a number of well-known sources, including two very notorious atheists, David Hume and Voltaire. And again, I keep saying this, but I want to make it clear. I'm not picking on David Barton himself. I'm picking on what he does, okay? He's very fond of carrying around a letter that he has laminated that was given to him by the Adams family, which you can understand why, in which he says, and he quotes this from the letter, a letter from Adams to Benjamin Rush. A portion of the 1809 letter is read in which Adams says glowing things about the Holy Spirit. So David Barton says, see, people say Adams didn't believe in the Trinity, but look at what he says about the Holy Spirit here. Concluding with, here's the last thing on that he reads. There is no authority, civil or religious. There can be no legitimate government but what is administered by this Holy Ghost. Wow. Maybe I need to rethink what I'm doing here. Right? That sounds pretty straight. Wow. That's an actual quote. That's in the letter. The problem is he stopped reading there. He doesn't read the next sentence. Right after the rapturous statements about the Holy Spirit, Adam says this, although this is all artifice and cunning, yet they all believe it so sincerely that they would lay down their lives under the axe or the fiery faggot for it. Alas, poor, weak, ignorant dupe, human nature. Do you wonder that Voltaire and Paine, who were notorious infidels, have made proselytes? And then he asked Rush to burn the letter, which, by the way, they did a lot of. They asked guys to destroy their letters when they knew they were writing stuff that the people in general didn't agree with, or ask them to send them back to them. Jefferson made a huge effort to get a letter back from a guy who died, from his widow. He didn't want it to get out to the public. There's a claim that in his 1776 Notes on Religion, Jefferson says, the Apostles' Creed contains everything necessary for salvation. So this is part of Barton's evidence that Jefferson was a Christian early in his life and then later rejected it. He says, Jefferson says in his Notes on Religion, the Apostles' Creed contains everything necessary for salvation. The fact, however, is that the actual statement is not personal. The actual statement is, and I have it right here, a photocopy of it, the Apostles' Creed was by them taken to contain all things necessary to salvation. Who's the them? The them refers to the people to whom the Gospels were written. So he's not saying he believes it, he's saying they believe it. Furthermore, it's even more removed, because Jefferson is not expressing his own views in the Notes on Religion. He's giving in encyclopedic fashion summaries of what others believe. He says, the Socinians believe this, and this group believes this. Right before this statement, Jefferson begins, Locke's system of Christianity is this. And then this quote about the Apostles' Creed is almost a direct quote, so there's one word off, from one of Locke's writings. A critical issue is, what did they mean? Christian America advocates take the use of the words Christian or Christianity at face value and quote them to evangelical born-again Christians, despite the fact that the person being quoted meant something entirely different than the audience understands by those terms, as some of you can see now. Adams, Jefferson, Franklin, and others had their own definitions of Christianity, which rejected virtually all the core doctrines of Christianity. When does this end? I want to leave time for questions, so I'm going to skip stuff.
Is it all
on your book? It is. There's explanation of the Declaration of Independence, which first of all is God words, not biblical terms. The emphasis is on reason, self-evident truths, not revealed truths, and on nature, nature's God, etc. But that's, and I argue that Jefferson wrote it artfully to allow everyone to insert their own views into it, and that's what people do. Secularists are comfortable with it because they can read the reason part in it. Christians read the Bible into it, and it was very cleverly written. Constitution is godless. There's no God mention of God. There's hardly any reference to God in the Convention or in the Federalist Papers. They could afford to grant freedom of religion because they didn't have a dog in the fight. They didn't believe in doctrines. That's why you and I have freedom of religion, because they didn't believe in any particular thing. All that mattered to them was morality, and so you can believe whatever you want as long as it teaches morality. Sunday's accepted, and the year of our Lord was simply the way that language is used at that time. There's no meaning to it. All right, why is the Christian America idea popular? First of all, those who promote it are not historians. I didn't know of a single Christian historian who is on the Christian America camp. In fact, there's a group of us who work against it together. Rather, there are self-proclaimed historians making a profit, and lots of profit off of it. Go to any Christian bookstore and look for tables, entire tables of videotapes, DVDs, books, etc. And then go to almost 365 days a year, you can go to an event someplace where someone is speaking and making a lot of money from it. Or they're lawyers. What's the lawyer's job? Present one side and win, right? Lawyers aren't there to gain justice. They're there to protect, either prosecute or defend. And then pastors, you guys, you trust the other guys and just get examples, right, for your sermons. You trust the people who are supposed to be doing the proper work. Human nature wants us to believe that our nation is specially blessed by God. Every great civilization in history, they believed God or the gods were on their side. The Romans deified their emperors, and Japan bombed Pearl Harbor for their god emperor, and the Egyptians cut out the middleman and deified the pharaoh, and so on. So there's something in human nature that wants us to believe that our nation is specially chosen by God. It's easier to call people back to a heritage than to call them to something new and radical like biblical Christianity. And frustration with public school teaching. Some people have this notion that because the public schools are dragging kids this way, that we need to teach the wrong stuff on the other side because it's a tug of war and we got to get the rag in the middle. No, that isn't the way it works. You don't teach falsehood on one side to correct falsehood on the other side. You teach the truth. This is theistic rationalism I explained before. To read more, you can buy my book. It's in the bookstore. It's on Amazon. I'm not doing this to sell books. You'd be amazed at how little I make from the books. I wrote the book not to make money, but to get what I think is the truth out there. If you have homeschooler parents in your church, here's an excellent book to get. It's called In God We Don't Trust by David Berceau. This deals specifically with the American Revolution, the theology of it, and the history of it as well. From a Christian, the guy is a lawyer, and so he goes into the legal aspects of the argument made by the patriots and so on, and I deal with that also in my book, but he does it really well, and it's at a low enough level that certainly high school and probably junior high kids can deal with it, and maybe even lower, so parents might be able to deal with it. Just a joke. Another one, this is out of print, though, which is what the OP means. The Search for Christian America by Mark Knoll, Nathan Hatch, and George Marsden is also good. Now, again, why did I do this for you guys? Because of the handout sheet that I gave you. I think this is it has consequences for the church, the Christian America notion. And I won't spend time going over it because you can read it there, and you're all theologians and whatnot, and so you can understand it. The backside of it is a comparison of theistic rationalism, which is what I'm saying these key founders were, with deism and Christianity, to show you how they were like and unlike those things, and to separate them from either side's claims. Questions? I'm going to say it. I know it's tape, but I'm going to say it anyway. Almost everything that he says is wrong historically or a misrepresentation. I have something I produced, one of his videotapes, which is why this historians group contacted me, is to write a review of this one videotape of his. I wrote a review of it, what I call a reader's guide, where I have his statement and then what the reader should know all the way through it, and almost everything in it is wrong. He and I agree on one fundamental thing. Okay, so let me get this out there. We totally agree that the whole wall of separation notion is goofy and wrong and invalid. The court is totally wrong, and the court is denying religious liberty to Americans. We totally agree on that. But all of the evidence to get there is very different. I shouldn't say almost everything. I haven't even read everything that he's done. Just almost everything I've seen. and in my interactions with him. I've interacted with him on radio and in World Magazine. You can look in World Magazine. I wrote something about the Jefferson Lies thing, and then he responded to it, and I responded to him. See, the problem, and you can see it in his explanation in the World Magazine thing, is I said, here's where this is wrong, you didn't quote this correctly, this is wrong, this isn't what it says at all. And he couldn't answer any of it. He says, well, I don't have time to answer all this, but I'm on the forefront fighting the fight. And so then I responded and said, well, no one questions that David Barton is a cultural warrior. The question is he an historian? And that's the issue. And he's really a cultural warrior rather than a Christian. Absolutely. I said that at the beginning. I don't know if you came in late. Yeah, at the beginning. Let me say that in case people came in late. I'm not here to say that none of the founding fathers were Christians. There were Christians among the founding fathers, and especially depending on how far out you make the circle of founding fathers go. And some of them were influential, people like Roger Sherman, for example. And so there were Christians among the founding fathers. I'm not here to say that there weren't at all, and that there was no Christian influence. It's just that they didn't have any real impact on the fundamental founding documents, the ideas, etc., that the country is founded upon. But there were Christians among the founders for sure. He said, how would I account for the notion that God has specially blessed America because of all of our wealth and victory and war and all the various things? And the way I'd account for it is the same way the Bible does, which is God is sovereign and he has a plan. You could have asked someone in Sparta 220 years into we're about 220 years into America. You realize Sparta had perhaps the most ungodly regime in world history? I could shock you with the Spartan regime. It lasted 700 years. We're only 220 years in. Or you can go through a number of other societies in world history that have been very successful and very powerful and so on and so forth that were completely ungodly. So I reject the notion. I don't think the Bible teaches it. You're all pastors. You could correct me. I don't think the Bible teaches that the fact that a nation is successful automatically means that God is blessing them in some special way. Obviously, he's blessing them in terms of common grace and in terms of it's his plan that they be at the top now, like Nebuchadnezzar, right? Jeremiah 27, Nebuchadnezzar, his son, and his grandson until their time comes, and then Assyria is going to come along, right? And so it's part of God's plan that America be successful and so on and so forth. And that's why I think America was successful. No, I'm not, because I haven't dealt with Christian Reconstructionism in quite some time because I've been doing this. Publisher asked me to write a book on Christian Reconstructionism years ago, and I didn't have the time, so I didn't. Just to say, I don't agree with Christian Reconstructionism either. Roger Sherman, John Witherspoon, John Jay, who was the first Supreme Court Chief Justice. Those three for sure, and other names are evading my mind at the moment. But those three for sure are important people. Let me just say this for homeschool stuff. If you have questions about your parents who are homeschools and whatnot, people often ask me, have you written a homeschool curriculum? Well, I don't have time to do that, and I don't write for that grade level. I couldn't do that. And I've tried to talk someone into doing it with me, and they won't. So here's the best thing I can offer you as far as homeschool parents for history, American history resource. Go online to used book sites and find a U.S. history text written before 1968. And it'll be from a secular publisher, but it'll just be U.S. history without the multicultural whole kind of thing on one side and without the Christian thing on the other side. It'll just be what I was taught when I was a kid, which was just U.S. history without all of the drama. That's the best thing I can think of. And there are some that are there. I found some. That we homeschooled our girls, and that's what we did.
That should be red flags right away.
No, because like he said, they're almost all pretty much the same. They're almost all infiltrated heavily with the Christian America stuff. I spoke at the ACSI, Association of Christian Schools International, it took me a few years for them to let me do it until I basically challenged the manhood of the president of the organization. I basically said, look, I'm an evangelical, born-again, conservative Christian who has an alternate perspective. I dare you to let me present it. And so he let me do it, but I had to share the time with one of the Christian America guys because they're so totally bought into the whole thing. And then afterwards, they let me do my own thing for several years. I did seminars. And I had, I don't know how many Christian school teachers came up to me after my presentations and said, we know what you're saying is right. I wish I could teach that, but I'd get fired if I teach that. And that's just the way it is. They're totally bought into it. Oh, absolutely. One of the problems, again, with the Christian America thing is to run a line from 1620 in Boston to New York in 1787 or Philadelphia in 1787. How alike is America to 167 years ago today? Or right? And it's only one colony, too. There were 13 colonies. Four of them had a particular religious, in the sense of a kind of a reformed influence. Then the one was largely Catholic, another was largely Quaker, and then the rest, the other seven, were just secular colonies. How come that's the one that is directly, you know, the feeder to the Constitutional Convention? And even then, if you look at the history, the Puritan Commonwealth ideal was dead by the turn of the 17th century, the 18th century. By 1700, the Puritan Commonwealth was dead as far as its pursuit of God and so on and so forth, with the halfway covenant and then the other things that came along afterwards. Right. That's exactly right. The Supreme Court, in their wisdom, in 1947, took a letter that Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists. Why? Because Jefferson was well known as an infidel. And you should read, by the way, exchanges between various pastors in the election of 1800. It's amazing. You know, they said that incest and rape would be openly taught and practiced if Jefferson's elected president. But anyway, so he wrote to denominations who wrote to ask him, are our religious freedoms in jeopardy now that you've been elected president? And he wrote to reassure them that they weren't. And there's a couple of really good books written about that, but the bottom line is, when he used the wall of separation notion, that was, first of all, his view, just his view, and he had nothing to do with writing the First Amendment. He was in Europe when it was written. It was just his opinion of it, and it was to assure them that the government was not going to interfere with religion, not the other way around.
You've reached the end of this audio presentation. For more audio or for more information on the Shepherd's Conference, please visit shepherdsconference.org.